Must faith in God be accompanied by obedience? Welcome again to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author. We're continuing our 13-week series, studying the Gospel of Matthew, and my conversation partners for this quarter are Troy Fitzgerald and Jennifer Ogden, who serve as pastors at the Walla Walla University Church. My opening question is, faith and obedience, are these two opposite extremes of life? Are they connected in any way? Must faith in God be accompanied by obedience? Or can I just believe that He exists and that's good enough? And especially as we study the book of Matthew, what options does He leave us?
I think they're the two hands of God, faith and obedience. I don't think you can have one without the other, but I think having faith, really believing God exists and that He is powerful and mighty and wonderful, that's going to lead to obedience. I don't think they're exclusionary.
No, and I think the way our Western mind sometimes thinks, we try and chop things up into nice, neat categories like that, but they don't. Back in going back to the Sermon on the Mount, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So, you know, your actions, your heart can follow your actions, and your actions follow your heart. It is, if we think it, instead of one or the other, we think about it more as a cycle or a circle of growing. That might be more helpful. I know it's just that for me too, what I invest, what I do, I tend to love, you know, and then what I love, I tend to do.
And invest in. Yeah. Jesus here in this lesson for this week, we find Jesus with a number of people. We find Him loving the unlovely and the outcasts. We find a centurion whose faith is commended. We find Jesus touching those who might even be contagious. But some of the stories deal with lack of faith. Jesus' disciples, He often calls them, "You little faith people. Oh, you of little faith." And we have a storm on the sea. Jesus is in the boat with them. And what happens in this story? Jesus is in the boat with His disciples. Tell me what happens.
He's sleeping. I think He's got the good end of the stick on this one. He's sound asleep in the boat, and His disciples are flipping out because there's a big storm, and they're frightened out of their minds.
Now, some people have said, this is Sea of Galilee. There's no way you get big storms on the Sea of Galilee. But I've heard other people say, no, the wind whips down through that gorge there and can stir up Galilee to white caps.
Big waves.
Yeah, and the questions that they ask, well, they're clearly frantic by what's going on. And you don't, we're not talking about people who get easily shaken by, you know, stormy waters. We're talking about seasoned fisher people.
They live their life. This is deadliest catch, right?
So if any of these disciples were here at the point where these stories were told in their authentic moment originally, then they would have said, that didn't happen that way. You know, we were fine. But no, they were there. They were frightened, it says in the text, to death, crying out for help. And Jesus rebukes the wind and the waves. I think that the awe that comes from this moment is a faith-building one. In other words, the disciples, when you see the Savior speak with His mouth to the wind and the waves.
And their response when they see it, who is this? Mm-hmm. Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey Him? What does this suggest about who they're with, who they are in the boat with? What would you have thought if you were there and had witnessed this person speak to nature and nature obeys?
I would be thrilled because I get extremely seasick. So I would be like, yes, my own personal Dramamine.
Yeah,
right. I mean, so that would be the thrilling part for me. But I think, you know, it would have been really shocking to have come out of such a storm to peace and calm and thinking, wait a minute, this is totally I can't do that.
No,
who
I can't do that.
Who is this guy?
Who is that? And the only, the answer to that question would have been obvious to any believer, even those who didn't believe, but still wonder about how this world came to be. God spoke the world into existence. Mm-hmm. He speaks the winds, and they obey the same way He did at creation. I think this is a beautiful picture of the Creator here.
Mm-hmm. Sometime back, I was visiting Multnomah Falls, a large waterfall in western Oregon, northwest Oregon. And I can imagine if somebody had stood up on the bridge at the base of the falls and said, "Stop flowing and go backwards," and the water obeyed them, that I would want to know a lot more about the person speaking. But there'd be a sense of fear. A person who could do such thing has a power that I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes wonder if we're a little bit too eager to make Jesus in our image. Mm-hmm. And there are things about Jesus where he definitely was not.
Mm-hmm. And when he steps outside of that image, what is our response to that? Well, there's wonder, but there is fear. Well, think about anyone else who surprised you with who they are, whether it be a hot temper or strange kind act that you were not expecting, and now you're looking and saying, wait a minute, there's a moment of awe and a moment of concern, maybe even a serious question that stirs in your mind.
But it doesn't end here. Jesus and his disciples go to the other side of the lake, and when they get there, more drama ensues. And I think if I were a disciple of Jesus then, I would almost be weary from so much happening all the time. They're at the other side of the lake, an area variously known as the Gadarenes, the Gerasenes, and Jesus is met by some men who have evil spirits. So I think one gospel suggests it's one man, some say two, it doesn't matter to me. But these men had broken chains, they had tried to be bound, and they approach Jesus and the disciples. I get an idea the disciples already understood demon possession in their day. And I think that they would have turned and tried to walk away from the situation. Jesus does not. Mm-hmm. What happens when the man shows up right in front of Jesus?
He calls Jesus out. He starts asking him, "What are you doing here, you Son of God?"
As if he knows already. Mm-hmm. And Jesus has never been to this region as far as we know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that addresses the whole question. So I've talked to people about this who like to humanize this whole situation of demon possession. And if you've ever been in a room or a place where you've seen somebody acting this way, your first response is, oh, clinically, this is a classic case of some sort of psychosomatic trauma or some sort of, there may be levels of that here, but when the scriptural record describes demons or the voice of the person speaking back to them, not only directly to Jesus, naming things about Jesus that are exalting his identity, you are the Son of God, or saying, get away from us, or don't do this to us, or don't do that. And it's us sometimes, not me. So it's kind of hard to argue from the text that this is just some sort of illness, a mental illness that somebody has.
There is more going on as well. We see these broken chains. We see that they have been unable to be bound by groups of men. Militia have tried to encounter these men and subdue them and have been unable. And yet now they come to Jesus, and Jesus says, who are you? And they say, we are legion, we are many. So there are many beings living inside this man or these men. And what happens? What does Jesus do?
Well, these demons beg for sanctuary in a herd of pigs, and Jesus grants their request.
So he sends the evil spirits out, and the evil spirits go and possess a herd of pigs.
Doesn't that seem natural to you?
Well, if you're a Jew, what would be the problem with this story?
Well, there's a bunch of pigs hanging around.
It's quite appropriate, I think, if they go to pigs, because a pig was probably the most unclean animal. I mean, if you really wanted to offend a Jew, you'd call them a pig, or you'd put a pig near their altar or on their altar, or you'd
cause them to touch one, and they'd be ritually defiled, unclean. Mm-hmm. They couldn't eat it. But here someone is herding pigs. They own them. And Jesus, in one fell swoop, frees demon-possessed men and destroys the livelihood of some innocent pig farmer?
Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. The whole city gets pretty enraged about it. I mean, this is a big deal.
Well, breakfast just went out the window.
Yeah, it did.
So,
as did the money.
Over the cliff.
Over the cliff, right, when pigs fly. The pigs are flying, and the demon-possessed man wishes to follow Jesus.
Yeah.
He wishes, he says, he's now clean, he's in his right mind, and he says, I'd love to come with you, but instead Jesus doesn't allow him. Why not?
I think that he wanted to stay with Jesus because he was afraid the demons would come back. There is an assumption back then that, you know, you get rid of one demon, there's room for seven more to come, I think.
Sure.
There's that kind of conversation going on. I think he wanted to make sure they didn't return. And Jesus tells him how to make sure they don't return. Go tell. Speak about it. Testify. This becomes what the New Testament church will do to exhibit power and to announce the kingdom of God to the world, to speak about what Jesus did and how he had mercy on them.
So while this man's first response to follow Jesus seems like the best one, he doesn't realize, but just maybe, he's going to be receiving a huge blessing.
Yeah.
If we were to jump ahead in the story, Jesus later returns and comes back to this area. What happens when he comes back?
It's a welcome mat. He was received well. The gospel goes out to this place, especially after Jesus goes to heaven. This part of the region where this gospel went, you know, talk about the end of the world or the end of the earth. It's up through there. It's right up in there.
It's right up in there. What a beautiful picture. Now, one last story. Jesus is back on the other side of the lake, and he's teaching in a home. Usually houses back then had flat roofs. We have a story of some men who are bringing their friend on a mat. And Pastor Jen, you referred to this story by a book you'd read.
John Ortberg refers to this group of four men who carry their friend in as the Fellowship of the Mat.
To borrow a phrase from Tolkien,
yes.
They lower their friend through the roof. They carry him up to the roof. They tear open the roof. They lower him down to Jesus, maybe with ropes on the corners of the stretcher. And Jesus, the words here are unique. He doesn't see the man's faith. He sees
Their faith.
Mm-hmm. The faith of the friends. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does that suggest about my relationship to people?
That my responsibility is real. That friends can bring their friend to God, and it's whether they want it or not, or whether they need it or not, they see the need in themselves. We need to pray. We need to lift. We need to bring our people before God with our faith. And God will look at what we do and respond.
What we do. So in closing, does obedience mean I don't need faith, or faith mean I don't need obedience? No, it sounds like they go hand in hand, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Next week, we'll be looking at the seen and the unseen war that Jesus was involved in, and that we find ourselves involved in as well. Pastors Troy and Jen, thank you so much for being with me. I also want to say thank you to David Olson and Jared Miller, our program engineers, and to all of you who are listening in for The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.